Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Joining us now is Arundhati Roy, author of the Man Booker Prize-winning novel from 1997, The God of Small Things, to discuss her new novel, The Ministry of Utmost Happiness, in which she explores intricacies of Indian society through the eyes of characters whose experiences range from living as a transgendered person in New Delhi to living under military occupation in Kashmir. Ms. Roy has written a great deal of nonfiction, as many of you know, between the two novels, and has been involved in causes ranging from the status of Kashmir to opposition to India's nuclear weapons program to opposition to the U.S. war in Afghanistan. Arundhati Roy will also be appearing in person tonight at 7:30 at BAM and joins us now in our studio. Thank you so much for coming in. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian.
It's been 20 years since you published your last work of fiction after winning maybe the most prestigious writing award in the world for your first novel. Why did you look away from fiction for so long?
Well, I never felt that if fiction wasn't something that I wanted to use, you know, as a product to regularly produce books, I somehow didn't feel pressured to look upon it as a career or a duty. And I always said that I would write a book when I had a book to write. So it isn't that I looked away from fiction, but it took fiction this long to visit me again.
And in a 2014 interview with the New York Times Magazine, you described being annoyed with the people who expressed regret that you hadn't, quote, written anything since your first novel. You said, as if all the nonfiction I've written is not writing. So do you think nonfiction in general isn't taken seriously enough as writing?
No, I think it's just that these are sometimes different universes that don't always overlap, you know. So I actually it's difficult for me to know which. In India, for example, the nonfiction is translated into every language, and it's extremely read a lot, talked about a lot, fought about a lot. So it's hard to say for me that isn't taken seriously at all. You know, it's just that the nonfiction is always written, my nonfiction, not all nonfiction, written with a great deal of urgency. It's published in mass circulation magazines. It's on the net. So it's a different kind of writing.
So you said you would write another novel when you had another novel to write, and now fiction has revisited you. Why now?
You have to ask it. You'd have to ask the characters who began to drop in on me about 10 years ago and then sort of moved in. And I was, you know, quite happily captive and worked with them and enjoyed it very much.
You want to tell us about, maybe for potential readers, even people not familiar with your earlier work, about one of these characters who dropped in on you and why you felt you needed to tell their story?
Well, actually, the Ministry of Utmost Happiness, you know, in some ways, when you, I think when you become very famous because of a particular work, it can domesticate you. You know, it can make you feel like you just have to keep doing the same thing again, and everybody wants you to keep doing the same thing again. And to me, the last 20 years of my life had a lot of journeys into places and worlds, and gave me sort of deepened my understanding of the place I live in. And then I wanted to, when people started coming to see me, for example, even the city that I live in became a person, is a person in the book.
Is that New Delhi?
New Delhi, yes. And all the characters from the woman who's called Anjum, who lives, who's born in the walled city of Delhi to a Shia family, and she's a hermaphrodite, and then moves into a house where a lot of transgender people live together within the old walled city. And then, she actually moves out of there and ends up in a graveyard in Old Delhi. But all of them are different. They represent a range of genders and characters. And also, she lives at a time where there's an overlapping view of this kind of thing, even in India, because there was a traditional space for them. And then now it's sort of shading into a newer way of looking at gender, more Western rights-based uh-huh. view. And so within the Khwabgad, the House of Dreams where they live, there are all these politics swimming around. And all the characters in this book, in fact, have a kind of incendiary border running through them. In the case of Anjum, the character I'm talking about is a border of gender, but there are other characters who live on the edges of caste or religious conversion, or Kashmir, where there's a war of a national border runs through characters. So in some ways, it's a look at a society that is actually ordered by the iron grid of caste and so on. But all the characters somehow have this grid running through them and don't fit into any one of the little spaces that they are meant to fit into.
And that is such rich territory for a novelist to explore, and really so important to the world, which is, I think, at least your equal motivation to talk about the people who don't fit into the conventional spaces and to have their stories told and to have them taken seriously, yes?
Well, I think the thing is that, it's not that these people are dropouts or outcasts or people who don't fit. The problem is with the grid itself. Actually, nobody fits. You know, gender is a spectrum, caste is a spectrum, class is a spectrum. And if you start trying to force fit, it can either turn into an even smaller grid, like almost a mesh, which precludes all forms of solidarity, which is exactly what people who rule us would like to see. Or then you have to look at this grid in a more complex way.
My guest is Arundhati Roy, whose new novel is called The Ministry of Utmost Happiness, and we can take some phone calls for her. Any longtime or recent Arundhati Roy readers, or anybody who just wants to join the conversation that we're having in the moment, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, a rare New York appearance for Arundhati Roy here in our studio this morning and at BAM in Brooklyn this evening in conjunction with the release of the book. And again, the number 212-433-WNYC, sorry, I might have invited you without actually giving the number, 212-433-9692. So you mentioned solidarity. How do you see the state of solidarity today? It's a very big question, but over the years, India has increasingly moved toward religious nationalism with the election of Modi and the riots in Gujarat and more. There's continued persecution of minorities, including the Dalits and the lower castes. You bring in the transgender question. We see what's going on in the United States right now. What's the state of solidarity, according to you?
It's been my experience that when things look really bad, perhaps it clarifies things. And I'm always grateful for any form of clarification, even if it means that it pushes us back initially. So in India, things are actually terrifying, because right now you you do have lynch mobs roaming the streets, beating Muslims and Dalits to death. Almost every day you hear of these incidents, sometimes watched by policemen. A lot of it is, you know, there's a sort of technique where WhatsApp as a means of communication is very big there. And so there are these WhatsApp groups which deliberately spread rumors. And based on those rumors, mobs gather and kill. Even Africans are attacked mercilessly on the streets. An ideologue of the ruling establishment said, "We're not racist because, after all, we live with these black South Indians." Mm. So the situation is really bad. And I think, you know, the idea of India being declared a Hindu nation, like Pakistan was an Islamic republic, began in the early 1920s when an organization called the RSS, the Rashtriya Swayam Sevak Sangh, came into being, an organization that has modeled itself on Mussolini's black shirts. And Modi and previous BJP prime ministers are members of this group. And so they have unleashed the vigilantes, the mobs on the streets, the massacres that have taken place, for example, in Gujarat in 2002 when Modi was chief minister. Muslims were massacred on the streets. Tens of thousands were driven into refugee camps. And there has never been an apology for that, because that brings the wrong kind of solidarity, of course. You know, it creates a constituency, and people are constantly being told this is the movement towards Hindu Rashtra, the great Hindu nation. And the violence of exclusion, as well as the violence of inclusion. You know, for example, from the turn of the century, there has been the violence of trying to include the big Dalit population into the idea of the Hindu nation while maintaining the practice of caste, while forcing them to live in, I quote unquote, the servants' quarters. You mm-hmm. know, so that's another form of violence. So we are living in very troubled times there, as you are here. Although, you know, it's different. I mean, here you're living in a situation where perhaps all the big institutions, including the media, are very alert to what is going on in the White House, whereas we are living in a situation where this process has been happening for almost 100 years and the institutions have been taken over. History books are being rewritten. Mobs are on the streets. Justice is not available to the minorities. And India, in a way, is a land of minorities, and they're trying to create a Hindu majority.
Samir in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Arundhati Roy. Hello, Samir.
Mrs. Roy, you're a great genius. There's an old saying that what Bengal thinks today, India thinks tomorrow. So taking that into view, what do you think about the prospect of China, India, and Pakistan breaking up as a result of occupying Kashmir's brutal occupation for the last, especially by India, since 1947? And do you think, because they use Kashmir as a place where it could be divided and ruled upon, that could be like a force to break up India, Pakistan, and China?
Thank you for your call. And just for context, for people not familiar with the issue, you've been an advocate of Kashmiri independence, yes?
Well, I've talked a lot about the fact that Kashmir is one of the most densely occupied military zones in the world. You have about 500,000 soldiers there, and people since 1947 have been struggling, though in the 90s it became an armed insurrection. And the army was fighting militants. But now what has happened is that the entire population has become militant. So today you see schoolgirls throwing stones at soldiers. And you see a situation that is careening out of control. So I want to say that, you know, I think what people want is people should be listened to. You know, so it's not that I have some solution that I'm trying to push, but to break people under a military boot, to have you know, hundreds of thousands of people out on the streets, to have tens of thousands of dead, unmarked graves, disappeared people. That is not a way for two nations who are both nuclear armed to have this conflict that can set off anything in the world, you know. So I do think that the questioner has a point, that attention needs to be paid to what's going on in Kashmir.
Biba in Jersey City, you're on WNYC with Arundhati Roy. Hello, Biba.
Hello, Brian. Thank you for taking my call. And Arundhati, I've been a great admirer of yours, not only as an author, but also as an actress. And that didn't come up in your conversation with Brian. So may I just reminisce and say that you were great in Massey Sahib. That was many years ago, right?
Yeah, it was.
and then you acted in another movie, which was, based in an architecture college. And I'm sorry, I can't get that name right now, but that was also very interesting. Oh, your role was so fantastic. So, you know, following you from being an actress, you know, to, and then I read your book, God of Small Things. It's just been, I guess, a great journey for you.
I think you have a little bit of a fan in Biba. thank you very much. Do you have a medium that's most satisfying for you to work in?
Well, at this point of time, I guess there's nothing that absorbs all my skills than fiction, you know, than writing a novel. But as I said, you know, I could never do it as a product.
Job. Some of the great novelists of history say they have to approach it like a job or they're not going to get it done. They get up at a normal hour, they sit down at their desk at 8 o'clock and they write every day. Otherwise, you know, and they have to treat it like that.
Well, that I'm not suggesting that, you know, you do have to be extremely disciplined when you're in it. But what I'm saying is that, you know, yes, she's right. I studied architecture and I did work in film. And for me, there are some times when I feel that what I need to do in an urgent essay cannot be done. You know, fiction takes its time for me. And there are so many different kinds of ways of writing. So, you know, there's no rules.
Here is some pushback from Jay in Somerset County. You're on WNYC. Hello, Jay.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Yep. No, I just wanted to put this in context, okay? When you say, Arundhati, that there are riots in the streets and this and that, you know, you make it sound like it's a violent country and there are people being slaughtered today. So let's just get that straight, that could not be furthest from the truth. Secondly, let's go back in history and remember that India, being a Hindu nation, has been invaded for centuries, okay? And it was a Hindu nation for many, 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 many centuries. So when you say that the Hindus are doing this and Hindus are doing that, let's keep that in context, that this was historically, you know, I sound like I'm being, you know, making it justifiable, but, you know, it was always a Hindu nation. And when you say that, you know, people are being persecuted and slaughtered, please tell us, what is the status of that currently? Because you make it sound like, you know, you cannot go walk into the street without being, you know, murdered. And so please, I would like you to explain the reality actually to the people who may not know that.
Well, it's true that people are being slaughtered. You know, people were slaughtered in Gujarat in 2002 openly on the streets. Women were raped and women were raped and burnt alive.
Hang on, one at a time. Go ahead.
And it's true that even today, just last month, you know, Dalits homes were burnt in Haryana. Muslims have been murdered for eating beef in Jharkhand. 7 people were beaten to death in the presence of 30 policemen. So I think
that was a recent incident,
very
right?
Recent, last month. last year, a man called Muhammad Akhlaq was beaten to death in front of his family by a mob because of a rumor that he had been eating beef. So people are being slaughtered. And, I mean, radio may not be the place to discuss this, but you must study your history, okay? So India was not always a Hindu nation. And if you read read Annihilation of Caste by Ambedkar, and you see how recently the word Hindu itself was coined.
I know all of that, but now let's look at the history of the riots in Gujarat, okay? And I've studied this. What was the origin of the riots? Let's review that. Let's review that there were pilgrims who were coming from a pilgrimage whose train compartment was burned. Let's remember how it started. You know, there's always a pushback. There's always a spark that causes, you know, these things. So let's not be one-sided is what I'm trying to say.
There was a train and pilgrims burned to death in a coach. The inquiry has still not been able to establish who did it. But surely the people who were murdered on the streets of Ahmedabad and Baroda were not the people who did it. So we cannot justify collective punishment. You know, this is the problem, that some people do something and then a whole community is expected to pay the price. The some people murdered Mrs. Indira Gandhi, 3,000 Sikhs were burnt on the streets or murdered on the streets of Delhi in 1984. We cannot be a society that condones collective punishment.
When you said, and Jay, thank you for your call, when you said that the word Hindu is relatively recent, that might have surprised a lot of people who think, well, Hinduism is one of the world's old and great religions, thousands of years old. So how would that lead to a recent coinage of that word?
Okay. I would say to people that they should read an essay called Annihilation of Caste by one of India's greatest modern intellectuals, whose name is B.R. Ambedkar, who talks about how the word Hindu, that the word Hinduism was actually used by Muslims and later by the British to refer to people who lived east of the Indus. And before that, the community that calls themselves Hindu used to describe themselves by their caste name. So, and before Hinduism came to India, there were indigenous people in India. There were indigenous tribes, there were Dravidians who were then conquered. So it isn't as though it existed since the dawn of time. It's a process of colonialism that goes on all human species. I mean, not just in India, here too, you know.
So one more on conditions in the country. Shanti in Kingston, Pennsylvania. You're on WNYC with Arundhati Roy. Hello, Shanti.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. Ms. Roy, I have the privilege of seeing you at the town hall probably about 10 or 12 years ago, so it's an honor to be speaking with you. I was wondering if you see a connection or a through line between this sense of grievance that I hear often from the Hindu majority in India and the sense of victimization and grievance that we've seen in sort of the white Christian nationalist movement that has been highlighted
in this country
campaign and since the election. Yes.
A through line between majoritarian sense of grievance in both countries.
Yes, though, although, you know, both are unique in their own ways. And Hinduism, as I said, is a very complex Hindu society. What we call Hindu society is such a complex society because it consists of such a range of castes, each arranged in a hierarchy, each arranged in a form that precludes all kinds of solidarity. And then we have obviously a huge population of Muslims, a huge population of Sikhs, of Christians, of Buddhists. So I think while human society is always trying to create a majority against the other. Each tries in its own unique way to do that. And as I said, you know, I think the whole world right now is in a form of convulsion. And what is happening in India, I would say that the expectations of the new middle class who rose from poverty at the cost, of course, of a huge underclass, are now frustrated because the economic growth is not providing the jobs or the happiness or the satisfaction that was promised. And at this moment, all the anger is being directed downwards at people who are more helpless, which are minorities, which are the Muslims, which are the Dalits, who have been pushed to the bottom of the food chain right now and are living in fear.
We're just about out of time. When God of Small Things was published in the 90s, a case was filed against you in India for corrupting public morality. That was the charge. Later, there was a sedition charge for, I think, things you had written about Kashmir or said. Now the new book is coming out, first novel in 20 years. And in an interview with another news organization, you said, it's the right time to publish this book in India, definitely. I just don't know yet whether it's the right time to be the author of it. Ha. Are you afraid of any real repercussions for you?
You know, one of the things about living in India right now is that so many people who are even more vulnerable than I are standing up and are in a lot of trouble. So while it's foolish not to be afraid, it's also important not to let that stop us from doing what we do. I mean, every 5 years, five male lawyers file a case against me. Of course, the first was for obscenity. The second was for trying to kill five men outside the gates of the Supreme Court. And then now it's I'm in a case of contempt of court about an essay I wrote about a professor who's disabled, who's been thrown into prison. And who knows, you know, but the filing cases against people is they know that the process is the punishment. Nothing might come of it, but the harassment is huge.
Did you say every so often five male lawyers? Is there a gender aspect to
always,
this?
Always. It's five, for some reason, it's five male lawyers. Something might change, but for the moment, yes.
Arundhati Roy is the author now of The Ministry of Utmost Happiness, and she will be appearing tonight at BAM. That is 7:30 at the Peter J. Sharp Building of BAM in Brooklyn. Thank you so much for making this one of your stops.
You're so welcome.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.